I'm glad you've all made it back, because I wanted to talk about being present tonight. So I was in number 8, still trying to work out what it was that I was going to try to express this evening. And I thought, well, I better put it in practice then. So rather than trying to think about what it was that I wanted to tell you, instead I practiced it. So I was just present. I was just here or there then, but here now, if you see what I mean. And I just waited. And I realized within a very short moment what it was that I wanted to tell you, which is being present is simple. I'm not saying it's easy, but what I am saying, well, it is easy, actually. You can't help it. Your nature, our nature, is to be present, meaning here now, meaning awake, aware, and at peace, tranquil, and it's simple. People come to meditation and often they will say, I want to meditate because I want to be more present. And that's a perfectly valid reason to meditate. But what we learn when we meditate is that being present is not the problem. Being present is not something to be accomplished. Being present isn't something that you construct and hold together. It's your nature. It's your natural state. You don't have to create it. You don't have to cause it. You don't have to manage it and hold it in being. It's simple. It's given. Being present is given. It is a natural consequence of existing. How can I express this to you? How is it, on the purely physical level, subatomic particles know where to go, what to do, how to come together to then create all the various organs and various parts of our bodies, which then enable seeing and hearing and tasting and touching and smelling and thinking and all the rest of it to take place? Or I ask the question, when was the last time you had a good conversation with your adrenal glands? Or you checked out that your kidneys were okay and they were happy with you and you were happy with them? Or is it the case that these things just happen? That we don't have to control them. We don't have to organize these subatomic particles to do what they do. This is just on a physical level. It just happens. I hope that's everyone's experience, because if that's not what your experience is, and that you do actually have to organize the workings of your entire body, good luck with that. It happens by itself. It's self-organizing, isn't it? And there is the possibility of experiencing, because of that gift, gift in inverted commas, it just happens. Consciousness is just happening. At this moment, consciousness is just happening. That's what I mean about the simplicity of being present. You haven't had to do anything. In fact, your responsibilities in terms of being a co-creator of experience are pretty minimal. So how is it then that we all don't experience this being present all the time? And this is where the Buddha's teaching comes to our aid. Because we know, in some way, shape or form, we know that life is supposed to be lived out in the moment, don't we? We know that the joy of life is being in the moment, dealing with issues that arise confidently, happily, and being able to take joy in life in the moment. We all sense that being in the moment is where it really all happens and where we want to be. How come we spend so little of our time actually being truly present and awake? And like I say, this is where the Buddha's teaching comes in very handy. So let's look at the other side of the equation. What are we doing when we're not being present? Essentially, we are always present. We are always here now. But sometimes we're here now, lost in thoughts about the past. Sometimes we're here now, but lost in thoughts about the future. Sometimes we're here now, but we're lost in thoughts about the present. And that seems to me what the complaint is. When people say, I want to be more present, what they mean is, I want to be less in the past, less in the future. I want to be less caught up in trying to control and manipulate the present and trying to get reality to conform to my wishes. I just want to be. Because there's that sense that if I am being, if I am present, if I am in the moment, awake and alert, well, there's lots of reasons why people would want life to be more like that. In very practical, mundane terms, it means you'll make better decisions and you'll be more efficient at work. I find it interesting that more companies are offering mindfulness courses. I don't think it's people's spiritual welfare they have in mind quite so much as their productivity. But it will work if you're not lost in resentments and concerns about the past, if you're not lost in worries and planning the future, if you're present and alert in the moment, you are able to be more productive, you are able to be more efficient. So there is something to be said for being in the moment. I was taken with, as I think many people have been, Emma Raducanu, who won the US Open somewhat spectacularly a few weeks ago. There was an article that I read yesterday which was pointing out something that she had said about the way she psychologically deals with mistakes in a match. And she said that what she does essentially is when she makes a mistake, plays a bad shot, she immediately acknowledges that she's made a mistake, and then she works as she's walking back to play the next shot, or whatever it is they do in tennis, she goes over exactly what caused the error. Oh, I didn't get low enough for that volley. Oh, I snatched at that backhand. She acknowledges the error, and she reflects on what caused it. She knows what's caused the error, and so it's finished. So when she plays her next shot, she has already cast that last experience out. And what happens over the period of an entire match is she's not building a story about how many mistakes she's making. And because she's not building a story about how many mistakes she's making, she's in the present, she's here now, she's not in the past. And then consequently worrying about her immediate future, because she's able to put that away and just deal with the present. And we know that what happens to sports people is that the pressure grows and grows because they keep making errors and they keep reflecting on those, and they're not sealing them off, signing them off, and casting them out of the mind. And I thought that was really interesting. So it meant that she was able to keep returning to the moment and deal with the new shot in the moment on its merits, rather than trying to make up for previous errors. And really that's what we want in our lives, isn't it? We want to be able to have dealt with that past issue in such a way that we no longer have to keep thinking about it. And we don't want to have to keep casting forward into the future to deal with problems based on the past, and then have to keep on thinking about the future because we want to be in the present. That's why we meditate, and that's why the Buddha's teaching is so useful. So we keep getting pulled, and that being pulled away from the moment is being pulled into the past, into the future, into the present, but the attempt to manipulate and change the present to make it what we want. And we know that's a never-ending process. You can never reach the end of it. And all we want, really, is to be present, to be here in the moment, free from those entanglements with the past, the future. So that pulling, that's what we mean by craving. A passionate desire for life to be different than it is. So we can't forget the old relationship. It keeps reoccurring in our minds. There's resentment there, there's painful feelings there. It shouldn't have ended that way, whatever it might be. Or we're casting into the future about potential problems for my family, potential problems for my community, potential problems for me. And that's a never-ending process. And it's a security issue, and it's a wanting to become something more than I am issue, and it's a wanting to gain pleasure for myself issue. So the Buddha talked about there being three kinds of craving: craving for sensual pleasures, craving for becoming, and craving for non-becoming. Craving for non-becoming is the attempt to keep everything the same, even though the fact that everything changes. Craving arises out of the assumption that somehow we can control life and that life should somehow be different than it is. We've got some kind of argument with reality. And that's essentially what suffering is, arguing with reality. And passionately craving for it to be different just exacerbates it and makes it worse. And we want to be free of that. We want to be able to rest in the third noble truth, the peace of the realization of the cessation of suffering. Fortunately, there is a path that we can follow. And following that path, the Noble Eightfold Path, will allow us to experience that peace of no longer having to argue with reality more and more often. It means that we'll be able to dwell in the present without manipulating it, without referring to the past or to the future that much more often. But it's not something that we create. Rather, it is we deal with the things that are pulling us, the things that are pulling us into the past, the things that are pulling us into the future, the things that are causing us to manipulate the present. In the absence of those manipulations, in the absence of that pulling and pushing, there is peace, and that is our natural state, and that is not something we have to create and maintain. We have to work at it the other way around and deal with the things that are getting in the way, the things that are polluting that peace, the things that are making the mind restless. If we deal with those, then what's left is the peace that we want, and that's simple. So the Noble Eightfold Path has essentially three trainings: a training in wisdom, so that's right view and right intentions. How does getting our views right and our intentions right help us deal with forever falling into the past or to the future? If we take on board and we are willing to look at life through the lens of the law of karma, the knowledge that our actions have results, and rebirth, that is to say that this conscious experiencing is a flow with no discernible beginning and no discernible end, that one life ends, the ending of one life is the opportunity for a new life to emerge, and where we find ourselves is based on the ethical quality of the actions we've performed. How's that going to help with our past? Well, if we are resentful of something that happened in our past and we're experiencing painful feelings and we're willing to look at it through the lens of the Buddha's teaching, we can begin to observe how the action of resentment, how the action of clinging to the past is actually perpetuating those painful feelings. And we can choose to let go of those painful feelings, knowing that they are the results of our own actions. Going into the future, we can determine that if our intentions are to be harmless, if our intentions are to practice non-greed, non-hatred, non-cruelty, that we're choosing the path of wisdom and to walk a path of wisdom and to act in accordance with that path, then we can be assured that our future resultants will reflect the actions that we're performing. What does this mean in real time? It means that you can let go so much more of the future. You can let go so much more of the past, because you relax into this wonderful self-organizing system which says, if you look after your actions now, your future will be fine. And so that's why we practice things like keeping precepts, developing service, and acts of relatively unselfish behavior will help to ensure that our future is going to be as happy as possible. Therefore, that cuts away at much of the requirement to dwell in the past and to dwell in the future. And yes, with intentions. I think I talked about this in the last live stream I did. But it is very much learning about what we mean by non-harming, what we mean by non-greed, non-hatred and non-cruelty. So we don't practice anti-hatred, we practice non-hatred. Anti-hatred would be to try to get rid of hatred. So it's aversion towards hatred. So it's hating hatred, which, as it might sound, is only going to cause you even more pain and distress. However, what's non-hatred? You feel a resentment towards a past relationship. It's a habit. You sit down to meditate. The memory of that past relationship arises in the mind. Because you've acted with resentment in the past, it's painful. To practice non-hatred would mean the acknowledgement that the response to that memory and the painful feeling is resentment. So you acknowledge that it is hatred. You acknowledge that it is resentment in that moment, which sounds counterintuitive. This idea that, oh, non-hatred is to acknowledge hatred, but it is. And what I was suggesting before the meditation was that if you're willing to acknowledge and stay with the hatred and not attempt to get rid of it, what happens? That act of noting and clearly comprehending and allowing the painful feeling and allowing the resentment to be there means you have a different relationship. You're not blindly acting out of that resentment. You're allowing that resentment. You're practicing love towards it. You're accepting it. You recognize that this is a resultant of past behavior, and that acknowledgement of what it is allows you to let go in that moment. And what are you letting go of? The desire to make it different. And as that hatred falls away, because it's the nature of everything to arise and pass away, the obsession with the past in that moment falls away. Now, it might be replaced in another moment with a similar memory and a similar feeling and a similar reaction, but that's just where you're under training, and it's going to take time to train the mind. But what are you training the mind to do? You're not training the mind to not experience any of that. You're training it to experience that. And the non-hatred is, through the acceptance of what's unfolding, you are not replicating it. And if you're not replicating it internally, it means you're not going to replicate it externally. So that's why it's not anti-hatred, that's why it's non-hatred. because you end up taking responsibility for it. You acknowledge that it's your own behavior which is causing it to occur again and again. Take ownership of it, and in taking ownership of it, you see it for what it is. You're able to let go of it. What remains once you've dealt with that? As that falls away, you're left with the simplicity of being, the simplicity of presence. You're not in the past. You're not obsessing. You've accepted it. You've accepted the discomfort of it. The discomfort falls away. Yes, it might take a few goes. It might take 10 years. It might take 20 years of practice. But eventually, you realize that that does not define you. When we're in one of these hindrances, we assume that it defines us. We assume that it defines our world. But the more you come out of these obsessions with the past and obsessions with the future, the more you are able to discern that there is a simplicity of being, of presence, of existence, which is not predicated at all or defined at all by that particular story that you're running. Moreover, you start to recognize that all these stories, all these hindrances, inverted commas, all these pulls into the past and into the future, they are just elements, components of conscious experience. They do not, no story defines, no story actually defines what's unfolding right now. We use concepts. We say, yeah, we've all gathered in the shrine room at the House of Inner Tranquility. It's very useful because it means we all know where to go on a Wednesday evening. Otherwise, we all go to different places. So we use a convention, an agreed upon set of concepts so that we can make sense of the world. The more you meditate and the more you start to realize that there is this indefinable simplicity of being which you have not created, and then you see in contrast how the mind gets pulled into this story about this problem either in the past or this problem in the future, you realize, no, hang on, that's not reality. It might relate to something, but in this moment, this is the reality. This is what's unfolding. This is the real. This is true. Shape and color is true. Sound is true. Tasting, touching, smelling is true. It's true that there are thoughts. It's true that there are feelings. It's true that there are perceptions. That is what is unfolding. And then the mind, quite naturally and normally, creates stories out of all of that in order to make sense of all of that. But the more you meditate and you realize there is this lovely simplicity of just being, which is nothing to do with striving to solve this and sort that out, you realize that there's this delightfulness in just being and allowing. And the more you rest in that undefined space, which is nothing to do with the past, and it's nothing to do with the future, it's nothing even to do with the present, it's the timeless now, you dwell in that, and you realize, well, this is the more presence that I always wanted. But you haven't really done anything to earn it, other than just do away with the things that were creating such a burden in your life. Oh, what a price to pay. You mean, like, if I just let go of all these burdens, I'll just be really happy? Yeah. We all carry burdens with us. There are burdens that are just part and parcel of being in the human realm. We can't live without responsibility. And I'm not saying that we all become Himalayan sadhu babas and we all live in caves half naked and learn how to sit in freezing cold temperatures happily. We don't have to do that. We can do all of this, but we have to recognize the difference between the way we conceptualize our burdens and the simplicity of being, which is our true nature. So there's this, each moment is an unfolding of conscious experience, sights, sounds, tastes, touches, smells, thoughts, feelings. That's true, that's what's unfolding. We all have burdens. So part of meditation is learning to have the faith to allow life to be unfinished. I've used the analogy in the past of spinning plates on sticks. When we sit down to meditate, we have to have the faith that we can leave all the spinning plates in our lives spinning in our absence, and that when we finish the meditation, they will be still spinning fine. Because that means that we can spend the period of the meditation not dwelling about the present, not dwelling about the future, not having to plan. So when planning comes up, we acknowledge it as planning. We see it for what it is. It's planning. That noting is so important because that's what allows, frees you from that time constraint, that obsession with the future. It's planning. That's the quality. It's arising now. We're always in the present. We're always here now. This is a planning for the future, which is arising now. The future doesn't exist. Now exists, and this thought is arising. And when you see the difference, it's like you're out of, you've freed yourself from the prison of time. In that moment, you've realized, oh, that does not define my experience. And as you realize that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself, you let go of that burden in that moment. Yeah, you know, the plates are still spinning. You haven't finished your life on planet Earth quite yet. You know, there's still things need to be done. That's your responsibility. You're not losing that at all. But it's allowing you to see the difference, which is then allowing you to treat those burdens in a more realistic and effective and pragmatic way, because you're not obsessing over them. So it means that you're able to dwell that much longer in the here and now, in presence. And when issues do arise that need dealing with, you have the freedom to be able to deal with them more effectively without all the worry and the painful feelings, because you have redefined your life. You are able to see that your life is not defined by these problems. Your life is defined by the simplicity of being. For many people, their introduction to Buddhism is based on the idea that they do want to be able to spend more time being present in the here and now. And that the reasoning may very well be because they want to be a little bit more efficient, or they want to be a little bit more there for their partners, or they're very understandable and genuine reasons why they want to be more present. But certainly my experience of practicing this way is that you don't have to go anywhere else in the world in order to realize the most fabulous secrets of existence and the mysteries of existence. You don't have to go anywhere else in order to become truly wise as to the nature of existence. That all you need to do is to be present and to be willing to enter more deeply into the moment, and to not to just be satisfied with a superficial level of calm, but to go deeper by exploring and investigating through this process of mindful noting, that it seems truly fathomless to me, that there is no end to the depth this moment actually contains. That in terms of Vipassana meditation, it's most certainly the case that we remain with the five physical senses and mind, and we explore the true nature of the transient, unsatisfactory, and selfless nature of existence, all of which happens here now in the timeless now. And as a consequence of that, you recognize the futility of craving as a way to happiness, to the point where you surrender that craving entirely. And there's this point of no return where you so clearly recognize the true nature of reality that you abandon passionate craving for life to be different forever. But from that moment on, you can deepen and deepen and deepen your awareness of the timeless present and examine how it works to a most, like I say, it seems fathomless. It seems there is no end to the discovery, no end to the mystery, no end to the exploration, to the point where I appear to have some spider's web or something in my head. Well, that was unexpected. It's been there the whole time. I was just getting to the denouement as well. Ruined that. To the point when, oh, it's on my head. There is something to be said for, I think in, is it known as Wei Wu Wei? Is that the word, meaning actionless action? That even through doing nothing, apparently doing nothing, yet everything is actually done. To the point where there is just a purity of being and the knowledge that nothing is required to be done. And there is just this fathomless depth to that, where you realize that everything, literally everything, is unfolding exactly as it should. Nothing needs to be changed, because change is inherent. It's all unfolding as it should, and there is literally just the unfolding. And it is the most sublime release from all burdens whatsoever. It's truly delightful. But the difficulty of meditation is dealing with the untrained mind. I've used the analogy before of the, it's like a puppy in your house, and you have to train it properly, because it's just going about the house weeing wherever it wants to, and we can't have that. That's what the mind's like. We have to go through the difficulty of understanding why it's being pulled in this direction, why it's being pulled in that direction, why it wants to obsess about the past, why it wants to obsess about the future. You have to become your own wise guide through the meditation, through reflecting on the Buddha's teaching, through getting personal instruction in meditation. You can come to understand exactly what it is that you do that creates that sense of not being in the moment. And as you let go, you realize that there is just this natural simplicity of being, which is what you had always been looking for, which had never been denied you. So you're not training yourself in how to become that. You're training yourself into understanding the craving that causes you to obsess about the past and the future. And in the absence of all of that, you'll find the peace that you're truly looking for.